Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm Vice Chairman of the Club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today. Tonight we have Dr. Greg Farrington, Executive Director of the California Academy of Sciences, speaking on the evolution of the new academy. He'll be in conversation with NPR Tech Nation's Dr. Moira Gunn. So we have the two doctors up here tonight in conversation. And we will have the two of them in conversation followed by audience questions. First of all, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Greg Farrington. The Academy's Executive Director, or Chief Penguin, as he likes to call himself, Dr. Greg Farrington faces a rare opportunity to help a beloved institution with 155-year history reinvent itself from the ground up and to redefine the role of natural history museums in the 21st century along the way. Since arriving, Farrington has focused the Academy's efforts on addressing two of the most important scientific questions of our time. How did life evolve, and how will it persist? The only institution in the world to combine a museum, aquarium, and planetarium, as well as research and education programs, the Academy is uniquely positioned to address these questions. Dr. Farrington brings a blend of leadership, scientific literacy, and fundraising experience to his role as executive director. He came to the Academy from Lehigh University, a highly selective national research university located in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where he was president for 8 years. Before joining Lehigh University in 1998, Dr. Farrington spent 19 years at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where he served as Dean of the School of Engineering and Applied Science and as Director of the Laboratory for Research on the Structure of Matter. A renowned chemist and prolific author, Farrington holds more than 24 patents and has written more than 100 articles in the fields of solid-state chemistry, electrochemistry, and education. He earned a Ph.D. in chemistry at Harvard University and a bachelor's degree in chemistry from Clarkson University. Just to tell you a little bit about Dr. Moira Gunn, in case you don't know her. Dr. Gunn is host of Tech Nation and Biotech Nation, which air in such venues as National Public Radio's satellite radio channels NPR Now and NPR Talk, and internationally to 177 countries. Produced at the studios of KQED in San Francisco, the programming can also be heard on over 200 domestic public stations and through podcasts via iTunes and other internet distribution venues. Dr. Gunn's early career included work at NASA on large-scale scientific computation and global communications, with special emphasis in infrared satellite imaging processing, computational fluid dynamics, and global climate and weather modeling. Dr. Gunn is the Associate Director in Information Systems and Assurance Programs at the University of San Francisco, and today serves on the Dean's Science Advisory Council at Purdue University and the Advisory Board of the University of and the Advisory Board of the Department of Mechanical Engineering at Stanford University. Let's welcome Dr. Farrington and Dr. Gunn.
And since you're the chief penguin, let's have happy feet, everybody. Let's go. It's just a special welcome at the Commonwealth Club here. So as the chief penguin, who is Pierre?
Oh, who is Pierre? You do your homework. Pierre is about to be one of the most, well, perhaps already, but about to be also one of the most famous penguins in the world. Because Pierre is the oldest penguin in our collection of penguins in the marvelous penguin exhibit. And when he got to be about 25, his feathers started falling off. And the other penguins picked on him. It's not easy to be a penguin when your feathers are falling off. And so what was going to happen to Pierre? Because 25 is really old for a penguin. And so our chief penguin keeper, Pam Schaller, decided to do something really creative, and that is create a small wetsuit for Pierre. So Pierre got his wetsuit. This isn't so easy, because penguins normally don't wear wetsuits. Pierre got in his wetsuit. It worked. His feathers grew back. Pierre recovered. Pierre bounced back. Pierre also recovered his, what you might say, penguinish mojo. Pierre took a young penguin for a mate, half his age.
Oh, you guys are all the same.
It is possible that we're all the same age. Now, Pierre was frequently seen sort of waddling off to his individual cave. The penguin exhibit has very good housing for the penguins. And what happens at night, we don't know. But Pierre is a very happy senior penguin.
Well, I just can't imagine that this was the vision of the founders back in 1853 of the California Academy of Sciences. That was just 4 years after the gold rush. What was their idea back then?
Well, that was a time, not simply in San Francisco, but also in the world, when the world, in a sense, was opening up and people were exploring the wonders of the world. Now, one way that one of the motivations was basically, you might say it came out of, it was quite consistent with religion, too, and that is what were God's, the wonders of God's creation. Not everyone traveled then. There was far less traffic at San Francisco Airport, I have a feeling, in 1853. And so what happened, though, is that people interested in the natural world gathered together. A small number of men here in San Francisco and formed a group to talk about the natural world and the discoveries in the natural world. This was going on elsewhere, not simply here in San Francisco. And institutions that developed from these clusters of people also tended to send out exploration programs, and the Academy is perhaps most famous for the one it sent to the Galapagos in the early 1900s. And the idea there was to go out and bring back collections of treasures of the world and show them to people, allow people to see them. So it was a combination of exploratory activity, research activity, and then public exhibition activity. In time, of course, the whole study of the natural world and ultimately of the nature of life has become increasingly central. And so now institutions that focus on these issues are no longer simply looking for the wonders of the world and sharing them with other people, the diversity of life, for example, but are utterly central in the discussion of the two questions you alluded to earlier, and that is, what is the nature of life? How did we get here? And how are we going to sustain life? The nature of how we're going to learn, how we're going to find a way to stay as humans on Earth. And so suddenly, we're not just a cabinet of curiosities. We're right in the middle of two of the most important questions of our time.
Well, I was very fascinated to learn that you have over 50 scientists and educators. There are 100 research and field associates, over 300 fellows, and with 11 fields of research, including ichthyology. Did I get that right?
I call it birdology. I find it's easier to remember that way.
I thought it was fish.
Oh, that's right. It's fish.
You're just still Pierre. I don't know. No, he's not fish either. I'm very confused.
It's definitely fish. There's no question. It's Greek.
But at any rate, what's the span the research that you're looking at?
Well, the Academy is not simply the front of the house, the front of the building, which is the public exhibition, the public engagement area, but it's also what goes on in the back of the house. And the two of them ultimately are fused, and the back of the house feeds the front of the house. What goes on in the rear of the house is a very large program of research and education. Research exploring the natural world, the diversity of life, and you might say three questions. We have a wonderful new dean of science. His name is David Mendel. He joined us from the University of Michigan last year. And his focus in the research of the institution is to say that the Academy is looking at three main questions, the first of which is, what is the nature of the diversity of life? How many living species are there? Where are they? How are they distributed? What do they look like? And so forth. The second question is, how does life support life? Living creatures aren't independent of each other. They're interrelated and they're interdependent. So how does one living group support another living group? And the third big question is, how will all the above, number one and number two, diversity and interdependence change if the climate changes? And these are the questions that link all of the work that goes on among the scientists and students and postdoctoral fellows and visitors in the Academy's scientific programs. So it's exploration, the study of interrelationships, and then the study of how climate change affects all the above. Ichthyologists and herpetologists and so forth and so on are the tribes, you might say, the names of the specialties of the people. But what matters most is the questions, and those are the three core questions in the institution, focusing in the institution's research programs. At the same time, the Academy has a wide variety of informal and formal education programs. The informal programs most people are familiar with. because they're what happens when you walk in the front door. That's informal education. Everyone who walks in the front door is a volunteer. You can't threaten them if they don't show up with an F at the end of the semester. It used to be easier at the university. They have to want to come to the academy, and then what goes on at the academy to engage them has to be very attractive and appealing. But we also have formal programs of education. We have a great program that welcomes a very large fraction of the fourth and fifth grade students in the public, private, and parochial schools of San Francisco to come to the academy for a great day's visit. We provide the transportation, which is an important issue. We're debuting this month a wonderful new program for annual cohorts of 30 teachers in third, fourth, and fifth grades in San Francisco, which will, it's called the Program on Teacher Institute in Science and Sustainability. And it will take 30 teachers a year. This year we had 90 applicants for that. And in a two-year program, we'll basically teach them a lot about science, natural science, and how to share it with kids. And that's going to over time, begin to infuse the schools in the city of San Francisco with some pretty interesting people who are very much connected with the academy and with each other. We have a lending kit program, which is teachers can come to the academy and take out what look like very large, the kind you'd never want to try to carry onto an airplane, but they look like that, orange suitcases, which orange, of course, being the academy's color. For reasons that, there is a reason, it just occurred to me.
I just thought the orange suitcases were probably the cheapest.
No, the orange orange is the accent color of the academy.
Oh, I see.
It's the color of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Right.
That's why the orange.
Right.
Anyway, putting that aside, they can take them out, and inside are all sorts of real specimens and real teaching materials that can go to the classes in the city. So we have not only formal programs and informal programs, they all add up to a very vigorous program of education for the educators and for the kids, principally in this city, but also beyond.
Well, this is the first science venue for which I went out to their website, and there was a whole separate section called Nightlife.
Nightlife.
From your website. Every Thursday, the Academy is transformed into a lively venue filled with music, provocative science, mingling, and cocktails. I'm game. Before we get to the cocktails, what's provocative science?
Oh, provocative science is science that forces you to think, makes you wonder whether you agree, disturbs your otherwise placid life.
And we give you a cocktail at the same time.
And we give you a cocktail to help you through with the stress. You know, it's provocative. Science is by definition provocative. Galileo found that out early, in case you're interested. He was very provoking, and the Pope was well provoked. So science by definition is provocative, and so what we're trying to do is talk about controversial topics, controversial issues. Great fun.
You know, the one of the first specimens which the Academy got very, very early on was a woolly mammoth. Mm. So when I discovered you now have 20 million specimens, I could see why you needed a new building. Now, give us a handle on the landscape of and size of the 20 million specimens. What's there, and how big is it?
Well, just for the record, the woolly mammoth burned in the 1906 fire, unfortunately. So much for the woolly mammoth. But the tusks of the mammoth are still in the Academy. The Academy over the years focused heavily on, as many institutions did, the exploration of the natural world. And what do you do then? You bring back samples. You bring back examples. Your dream is to really discover a great new bug, a new animal, a new plant, and then to bring back the archetype specimen of that and catalog it and preserve it for study and for future generations. Well, the accumulated process of this over the life of the Academy has resulted in about 20 million specimens. Some are big, some are really small, and they all reside quietly and comfortably. By the way, they're the only creatures, so to speak, in the Academy that get to be air-conditioned. The rest of the place, if you're alive, you don't get air conditioning. You get fresh air. But if you're a dead specimen, you're in the specimen storage area, which is between the back part of the Academy, where science and education and administration are, and the front part, where visitors are. And so there's drawer after drawer, cabinet after cabinet of living, of dead specimens, plants, animals, insects, and so forth, fish. What's so important about it is it represents a library of life and a library of life over time. And so now that one can apply the science of DNA analysis to life, these specimens that have been collected and preserved over decades and decades are extraordinarily important.
They'll surely underline creationism.
Yes.
There you go. Now, you've had some fantastic recent experiences with the opening of the new museum. Everybody's heard about the Grass Roof. Let's hear about the Grass Roof if you haven't been there. And give us just a couple of ideas about what things you like the best.
Well, it's not a grass roof. We
oh,
don't have to mow
roof.
It. It's a living roof, and it's
oh,
a
it's
green
a living
roof.
Grass
and
it, is on
and
it,
it has a,
no grass
no,
on
no,
it?
It's not grass.
It's I'll tell you, journalists, they get things wrong.
Yeah. They think, you think everything is grass. It's not.
It's I mean, grass.
Plants come in different types. Anyway, the roof, the living plants on the roof were originally chosen. They were auditioned from a selection of plants that would likely survive on a roof under those conditions and represented native California species. Those that survived in a test garden in this region were ultimately planted on the roof. And the roof is doing very, very well. But it raises some interesting questions because the living roof, which is 2.5 acres of space and quite beautiful in its own way, is the only plot of native species in Golden Gate Park. Because Golden Gate Park is not native species. And there will be many gifts to the living roof that come from the wind, that come from very helpful birds, that come from all sorts of things, whereas seeds will come in from the outside. So that raises an interesting issue of political correctness. Do you weed out the non-native species, or just weed out, or how do you weed? And does the living roof become truly a living and integrated part of the world around it, or does it remain a special zone of totally California native species? And so these are some of the issues that botanists are dealing with in the living roof. At the moment, of course, living roof is just a very beautiful roof, flowers and plants and bees. We have a couple of hives on the living roof, and we're also looking into putting in wind turbines up there not to make wind, to generate electricity.
And now, what other of the new features of the new academy do you like?
Well, I love so many things in the new academy. I love, in particular, the aquarium. I love it especially at 7 a.m. when I have it totally to myself, and I can sit in the big tube that leads under the flooded Amazon forest and just sit there and watch these fish swim around me. I love the rainforest. I didn't think I was going to love the rainforest until I went in the rainforest, and then I fell in love with the rainforest. The butterflies and the birds and the frogs and the leaf cutter ants that are on a mission of taking over the universe. We have a small leaf cutter ant issue that we're dealing with. Only in an institution like this can you see memos flying around about the leaf cutter ant issue, which is a certain charm to that. I think one of the things I most like is watching kids. And shortly after we opened, there was a kid downstairs in the aquarium, which tends to be somewhat dark because it's dark on the lower floor. And there was one little kid, maybe 7 or 8, came up to one of our scientists and said, "Hey, are you a scientist?" And the fellow replied, "Yes, I am." And the kid said, "Well, give me a high five, because this place is awesome." And then there were two kids, a boy and a girl, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 again, in line for the rainforest. And the little girl, after a while, turned around to the boy and said, "I'm really worried about this, going in the rainforest." And the boy said, "Oh, why? Why?" She said, "Well, you know, I'm really worried about the bats." And he said, "It's going to be okay. It's going to be totally okay. You will be just fine." Great. A few minutes later, the little boy said to the little girl, "You know, I'm worried about something, too. The butterflies worry me. I'm worried about the butterflies." And she said, "It's going to be fine. The butterflies don't take prisoners. You're going to be okay." And so there was this sense of anticipation. The two of them were reinforcing each other's courage while they stood in line for the rainforest. And I'm sure when they got out of the rainforest, they were sort of entranced by the magic of it. Which is to say, the most interesting living creatures in the academy for me are watching human beings relate to this world that's real. It's not a world that's on a screen. It's not a world that's in a textbook. Everything is real. And real is a lot better than virtual because it's right there and you can see it. That's why I call it the kingdom of wow, because it's the most often heard word, wow.
That's fantastic. It's really interesting. It's been so popular. People are saying, you know, they're planning to go there. When they're planning, they're doing that. It's not just, maybe we'll go over there. It's like there's a real intent to it's a real destination location, if you will. I understand that you've had your millionth visitor.
Oh, yes, we had our millionth visitor. We had our millionth visitor about a month early. Now, there's a problem with having a millionth visitor. It's actually not a problem with having the millionth visitor. There's the problem of deciding who is the millionth visitor. And we decided we were going to give the millionth visitor a rousing welcome. And those of you who've been to the academy know that the front part of the academy, the entrance area, is all glass, a wall on the world in front of it, and the piazza behind it, more glass. And there, so we decided that the visitors who walked in at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a particular day in March, as I recall, would be the millionth visitor, because you can't, you don't know exactly. And so we assembled the staff to stand around the lobby and on a sort of bridge overlooking the lobby. And two of us were standing by the front door waiting for the millionth visitor. And then I said to the fellow standing with me, I said, there's a bit of a risk here. What happens if the millionth visitor is wearing a big sign, a big T-shirt saying, "I hate natural history museums"? Or something similar to that. So we decided that we would have a little flexibility in the definition of the millionth visitor, that we would hold our watch back just in case. Well, at 1 o'clock, though, walked in a 10-year-old boy with curly hair and his grandfather. Central casting. The lobby erupted in applause and cheers of the staff. Now, you might wonder what the 10-year-old would do. The 10-year-old would say, "Oh, my goodness, I'm in the wrong place." They're all cheering. No. This 10-year-old walked in as if every time he enters a building, there are 200 people cheering. And he sort of looked around saying, "I expect this. Yes. And so he got a ball cap. His grandfather got a ball cap. His grandfather got a year's membership, and he got a frog puppet, the whole thing. And it was just tremendous because the 1 millionth visitor 1 month early was sort of the distillation of everything that's wonderful about the institution, a 10-year-old boy and his grandfather.
Now, that spells fabulous success, but I don't care who you are or what you are or what you're doing. In these days of economic meltdown and the fact I can't pick up the paper every day or bring it up online without hearing what they've cut next, what is your financial, I'd use the word landscape in these times?
Well, finances. That's the other side of the brain. The reality is that the academy is a very expensive place to operate. It's living, after all. And as I joked to the board of trustees one day, I said, next time you get the urge to build a museum, build an art museum, because the paintings don't eat. And remember, all of our living creatures, all 38,000 of them, eat. And many of them have different diets, and they all get good medical care. It's a great place to be a fish, I'll tell you. So... And you don't turn them off at 5 o'clock. It's 24-hour day, 7 days a week, 365 a year. And so it is actually a very expensive place to operate. It's actually more expensive than we anticipated because the building is so unusual. It's the only one of its kind. It was very hard to really project the operating costs. And a large fraction of that has to come from the earned income that we make. Many people think that we are printing money, to be quite blunt about it. We're not. I tried it. It didn't work. We are not printing money. So many people have fallen in love with the Academy, they become members. And so a large fraction of the people in our lines, people say, look at the lines, look at all the tickets they're buying. A large fraction are people who simply are coming back. And we're finding that people, on average, tend to stay longer, maybe closer to 4 hours instead of 2.5. They tend to come back more frequently. We have some people coming back every week, literally. And they just plain love the place so much that the lines and the enthusiasm out front, which is a sign of success, it is tremendous, doesn't translate to necessarily a large income stream. So while we are financially stable and while we are meeting our projections, we're not minting money. And it is an extraordinarily expensive place to operate. But that's just in the nature of the institution.
And it's a changing dynamic as to, you know, how many people are coming and what does that mean and what is the overhead. So that's,
well,
it's interesting.
One of the concerns we have is the first year is a very popular year. And this year will be easily the second most visited tourist attraction of its sort in the state of California, San Diego Zoo being number one. It's something like the ninth in the United States among cultural institutions, roughly speaking. Sustain it, considerably larger than Alcatraz. Sustaining that, I'm now in trouble. Sustaining that is a challenge, and so we want the Academy to always be fresh and always be engaging and always be interesting so that whenever you come there, it's a fascinating place to be.
Now, you are an international center for scientific education and research. I was wondering if you'd tell us about some of the expeditions that the scientists have undertaken.
Well, it often is hard to find a scientist at the Academy because they tend to be elsewhere. Elsewhere can be the Sierra Nevadas collecting beetles and looking at how the distribution of particular beetles in the mountains reflect climate change. It can be in Sao Tome off Africa. It can be in Madagascar, where Brian Fisher, one of our most enthusiastic scientists, is studying life's diversity and on that very special island, Madagascar, through the lens of ants. Just ask Brian about ants, and you won't escape, because you'll always feel guilty if you ever do anything to one in your kitchen. After that, it is, you develop a whole different view of ants. And so we have Healy Hamilton, who is a seahorse expert off in the Pacific. And then we have our folks in the Philippines studying fish and the corals in the Philippine Coral Reef, which mirrors our Philippine Coral Reef in the Academy. And so the scientists tend to be all sorts of other places. Now, this isn't five-star hotel travel. They will be in a tent in a rainforest where it's wet. That's what makes it a rainforest. And where the facilities are somewhat limited. So you've got to be really committed if you're exploring the world this way. One of our newest people is Zuraya Alemzaged, who's a marvelous new anthropology curator whose dig is in Ethiopia. He's Ethiopian, and his dig is in Ethiopia, and that means going to Addis Ababa, getting his team, everything from the trucks and the students and the researchers and the guards with the guns, and then driving into the desert and staying there for a month while they dig fossils. It's not exactly a crystal cruise, but it's how the nature of life and the diversity of life are explored by our scientists.
Now, in terms of diversity of another sort, you were in the Department of Materials Engineering, Material Sciences and Engineering at University of Pennsylvania, where you rose to be the Dean of Engineering and Applied Science. Being a dean is really a challenge. Then, of course, you went on to become the president of Lehigh, and yet another challenge. And a friend of mine who's a dean likes to say, well, I actually can't get any of the faculty to do anything, but I can move the food. you know, as a management technique.
Smart deal.
I'm thinking, you know, you've managed some pretty interesting organizations that I think Ross Perot would not understand. I don't think he has a chart for that. But now you're at the California Academy of Sciences. With that backdrop, let's talk about leadership in a place like the Academy. How do you manage that?
Well, universities and probably museums, and definitely the Academy, tend to be places that have many different groups, each of whom thinks it has the opportunity to decide which direction north is. And if they don't like the real direction of north, well, you know, we'd prefer to be a little to the right, you know. And if you're going to do anything in any institution, it applies to any institution, but particularly universities and certainly places like the Academy, you have to have a definition of north. And everyone has to have that as a common definition. That is, what is success? What are you trying to do? What are the real goals of the institution? Why are you here? Institutions like universities and museums exist by the grace of society, which allows them to be nonprofit institutions. It's a kind of gift from society, which brings with it an obligation to give back intensely to society. It's not just an opportunity to do what you love. And so you have to think about, why are you here? And what is your mission? And how do you fulfill it? And particularly, how do you fulfill it now? And for the, not how you fulfilled it 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but how do you fulfill it best for the times we're in? So you have to have a clear set of goals, and you have to have a clear definition of north. You have to talk about that with people and share that with people and have people contribute to that in its definition. But once you define it, it's something that people have to say. You can't opt out of it.
You keep the food on the goal.
Yes. There is the added issue of food. But we wouldn't want to go there, would we?
Okay, we wouldn't
want to do that. No, the goals are very important, and the several things you have to be committed to. Number one, what is the goals? And they have to be the right goals. Number two, you have to always hire the best. Number three, you have to reward people who are doing very, very well, and you have to help people who aren't understand they're not, because if you don't tell them, how are they expected to know? And you have to reward them when they do. And if you do that, the human race behaves in relatively predictable ways, which is generally positive. So that's what we're doing at the Academy.
Now, you're committed to inspiring sustainability and promoting biodiversity, which basically they go hand in hand, obviously. What are the actions that you take, whether it's in initiatives or in goal formation, or in just whatever you do, that really is directed towards sustainability and biodiversity?
Well, biodiversity is something that I would say we want to see preserved. It exists. It's already here. And what we're saying through our research questions, for example, is that life is interrelated. And when you destroy this living species, it may have an impact over here you never dreamed of. So have reverence for life and respect life. Sustainability is a related issue, but not exactly the same thing. Sustainability is, for goodness sakes, every person born on this earth has an equal call on its resources. How are we all going to find a way to live within the constraints of the earth's resources and live good, productive, as comfortable lives as we can? And that challenge is one that we're a long way from meeting. Some people live very, very good, very comfortable lives, and other people live quite unpleasant lives, lives quite disconnected from resources, the principal resource in so many ways being energy. What we're trying to do in the institution, we're not saying we have the answers to all these problems. We're not saying we're going to create the smart car. We're trying to raise people's consciousness to the importance of it, awareness of the importance of living as much as possible sustainable lives that have reverence for life with a capital L. It creeps into your psyche. I find before I came down here, I decided, because tomorrow is trash day, I decided to empty the trash cans. What did I in the house? So what did I find myself doing? Sorting the trash into the paper that really should go into recycling, and thinking to myself, you know, my wife and I have to talk about having two buckets by our desks. You know, the stuff that's going in recycling, the stuff that doesn't go into recycling. 10 years ago, I never would have thought about that. But now I'm acutely conscious of what goes into a landfill and that it's likely to be there forever and that recycling is a very good thing. So how do I do that? And it's crept into my psyche. Well, the entire academy is a lesson, is an opportunity to be reminded of these issues from the men's and ladies' rooms, which have little signs saying basically, well, I'll leave the signs to your imagination, but they're good signs, to almost all aspects of to the trash cans that don't come as a single trash can, but come with one that says landfill. That means if you put something in there, it's there forever. So maybe you ought to look at the other two, one of which says compost and one of which says recycle. You ought to think about that. And what we want people to do, we don't want people to come in and feel they've been beaten over the head, but we want people to be inspired to think about these issues in their own lives. And we have handout material, little cards you can take home that help you with this thinking. And we want to, in that sense, inspire change among the people who come and visit us. There's no magic wand you can wave that will change the world. It changes one community at a time, and we want to influence the people who are our community.
Now, you have talked a lot about children and the experience of children at the academy, but I know that you're equally committed to communicating science and the learning of science to adults of all ages. Why is it important that adults continue to learn science?
Because some of the most important issues of our time are issues that involve scientific thinking, technological change, and decisions about what we do with those issues. They're not going to be made by children immediately, but they are going to be made by voters. They are going to be made by people who are or are not comfortable and tolerant of a school system that basically doesn't teach science. Adults can influence that. Kids can't. Kids become the victim of that. So we want kids' minds to be opened up to science, but we want adults to begin to grapple with the fact that our society is driven in so many ways by scientific and technological change. And some of the most important issues that society is going to be facing in terms of ethics, national choices, international relations, global politics, are going to have to do with the nature of life and sustainability. And those decisions are going to be made by big people. Science is not just an interesting sideshow that you should occasionally perhaps read an article about it and then go back to life. Science is driving an enormous amount of change in our society, as it has for centuries, and even faster today. What's going on at UCSF, having to do with exploring the nature of life, is really important. But the decisions about how the results of that research are going to impact society are going to be made by real people, real voters in this country. Best people know something about it. Best people are not tolerant of school systems that don't teach science, that treat it as some sort of interesting extra. It's central. It's core. It's at the very center of the decisions about our future. We're concerned with people of all ages, I can assure you, for those reasons.
Well, I'm really in favor of democracy until we have to vote on something that requires an understanding of science. So when 90% of the people don't understand it, I really get nervous. I'm suddenly not so big on democracy anymore. Do we have our questions here? I think we're ready to go. And continue filling them out and passing them over. This we can get that. Here's a question. Can I join the fossil dig for my vacation?
Probably not. Because... But I'd be happy to introduce you to the fossil digger. And I don't know whether he has a volunteer program. If he does, I'll allow him. He'll be happy to talk with you about it. But remember, you're getting in for some really rigorous digging. And so I'd be happy to introduce you to Zir Ilemsaged, and we'll let him determine that.
What happened to all the old exhibits we knew and loved? And I loved that African, you know, the African scene. Are they ever going to come back out? And where's the carousel? Only I don't think that's part of the academy, right? But it was close by. There you go. That, maybe you know. You live close by.
No, I don't know much about the carousel. Some of the most popular, before when the new academy was being planned, it's quite a bit of consultation that went on with the community as to what do you really love about the old academy. And people really loved African Hall. So African Hall is back. All the dioramas are repainted and modernized. All the animals have gone off to the dry cleaner, and so they look better than ever.
No more peeling paint?
No more peeling paint. It just didn't have much future. The alligator swamp is back with the original seahorse railing, a beloved sort of iconic exhibit of San Francisco. The colonnade of the Steinhardt Aquarium is back in a recreated form. The pendulum is back. It is amazing how people stare at the pendulum. Now, the great thing is when we started up the pendulum, it worked again. The earth had been rotating all the time we were closed. It was so reassuring. But people will stand around the pendulum and wait for it to knock over a peg. The question is, who puts up the pegs? My lips are sealed.
I always count how many are on the ground.
But there's a lot to the academy, of course, that's new. The fish were there, sort of. I mean, the concept of an aquarium. The rainforest is new. The planetarium is a completely new kind of planetarium that has much more flexibility and freedom in telling the stories of science. So the academy is a blend of what was there and what is refreshed and rejuvenated for the next generation. But, you know, the academy always was that. Before 1934, there was no African Hall. Before 1923, there was no aquarium. And after 1906, there was no mammoth, unfortunately. So it's a living institution that is always changing. And very few institutions like that get the chance to really, or have to really, knock down the old and build anew. And it's a moment of nostalgia, but it's also a moment of enormous opportunity. And what you see out there has been a brilliant reinvention of the institution.
How are you reaching out to serve people beyond the physical building in the Bay Area?
Oh, this is something I call the Omaha Project, just because I chose Omaha, halfway between here and our lovely city of Philadelphia. I'd like to think that the Academy exists at 40,000 feet and has two earthly manifestations. One is a building where you come. The other is the expression of its mission in society, largely through the World Wide Web, largely through the Internet. And so the power of the web is such that now an institution that's in a place can be every place, too. It opens up all sorts of collaborative opportunities and all sorts of opportunities for us to express our mission in the broader world. I chose Omaha as how do we make the Academy relevant to people in Omaha? It's a good question. If it's Omaha, it's Paris. You can choose your location. So we have a very vigorous program of inventing ways to express the Academy's mission over the web. We have teacher lesson planning materials, a whole collection of them we've created in the last 2 years that are on the web. They can be used by teachers anywhere. I'd love to get all 20 million specimens, and in time we'll probably have them, accessible and visible on the World Wide Web so that our collections, which are now accessible only by people who come here, can be accessed everywhere in the world. One of our researchers on a recent trip blogged steadily during the entire trip. And that's very interesting. What's he doing today? What's he learning about? Which birds has he sighted and so forth and so on. So there's a whole range of opportunities for us to use the distributed Internet to express our mission, our core mission. The mission stays the same, but in a much broader framework. And we're in the midst of trying to imagine and carry that out.
Are there exchanges of staff and foreign students, or is it mostly we're taking our scientists and field people and sending them out?
Oh, there are always people from other institutions coming to visit the Academy. There's no such thing as national science. Science is by definition global, and so if you're in science, you don't think of Chinese science or English science or American science. Science is just science, and so everyone mixes up, and it's great fun. And the web makes that a lot easier than it used to be, which is also great fun. So, and our people are going out, so there's quite a bit of flux there. We're only going to see more of it in the future.
How would you measure or identify the other natural history museums in the United States, and where do we stand? Not that we're pressing the point.
Well, of course, California Academy is the most innovative, imaginative, and definitely the newest. Actually, the Academy is, let's see, there are two that are older, I guess, the Smithsonian and the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, which is where the Lewis and Clark exhibition began and so forth, 1824 or something like that. The American Museum in New York is younger. The Field Museum in Chicago is younger. So interestingly enough, what was created here during the Gold Rush, which was a very different San Francisco, was one of the first historically institutions of this sort in this country. One of the oldest is in Paris. It's magnificent in terms of its collections. Our goal is to be the most innovative. It's to try to define not only... Building buildings is almost easy. All it takes is a lot of money and a good spot and a great architect. But rethinking how you carry out the mission of the institution with the tools we have today, the most effective way we can, that's really challenging. I call it the play versus the stage. And the new building challenges us to reinvent what it means to be this kind of institution. It's why I refuse to call it a natural history museum. Natural history museums are supposed to be like many museums, dark. You're supposed to get lost. The food's supposed to be dreadful. They're supposed to be quiet. And instead, the Academy is light with glass walls. The food is excellent, by the way. And we want it to be very engaging. And we want it to define how you express this mission in the time we're living in. That's our big challenge and the one we're working on. Because the new Academy cannot simply be the old Academy in a new box. It's got to define what it means to be the new Academy as well as to be within the new Academy. Doesn't that sound like fun to you? It does to me.
Now, you mentioned the World Wide Web, but what about social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, you name it? Are we using that at all?
I've been on Facebook for years. How else do you find what the fraternity guys are doing on Saturday night? The problem is you actually know what they're doing on Saturday night, so finding out wasn't really necessary. Yes, we are using those tools. Particularly, they are lively around nightlife. Nightlife is an opportunity for a group of people who normally don't go to institutions like this. No kids, over 21, 21 to 40 roughly, to come and experience the Academy, which is full of life and full of fun. And every week we're getting between 3,000 and 4,000 people coming out. It's a demographic that generally doesn't participate. And one of the interesting characteristics of the Academy is the fraction of people we have visiting who don't have children with them. You see, the Academy is not just for people with kids, although the kids are really important. Now, the social media plays a big role in the Thursday night programs because this is the generation that Twitters and Facebooks and MySpaces and blogs and so forth. We have been voted the hottest date spot in San Francisco by Seb Magazine. We must be doing something right. After one early nightlife, someone put on Facebook, and the director was walking around like a proud parent or something of the institution, and he looked just like Hugh Hefner.
Ouch.
I had to check whether Hugh Hefner was still alive. Ever since then, I've had several offers of red sort of robes. Smoking jackets.
Oh,
and my wife had one offer
not?
Of bunny ears, which I have yet to see appear. So, yes, the blogs, and we monitor them, and we're connected with them, and we have a whole operation that is focused on those media.
In fact, if you're in one part and your friends are in the other, you can be Twittering and you can put your hash sign with tonight's event, so you can see everybody what everybody's doing. So
yep.
it's
great
a
fun.
Really, really neat thing. Now, we realize that the Academy is new, but it's like, what have you done for us lately? How do you determine what new exhibits you will have? Has that been worked out yet?
Well, interesting you should ask. We want the Academy to be constantly new. And people often think in an institution like that, new means a new big exhibit. Okay, we will, by the way, have a new big exhibit next spring It will be a program that we worked with at the American Museum in New York on extreme mammals, mammals that didn't quite make it in the real world but are really interesting to look at. It opened in New York about a month ago to great reviews. It'll be coming to the West Coast here to the Academy next April. It'll be great fun. Come to the Academy to see it. But we also want the Academy to be new constantly. So we want it so that whenever you go there, something's new. I'll give you an example on Saturday. On Saturday, on the West Garden, where people have their lunch and it's a nice lawn and a nice place to sit out and let your kids run around, there was a large inflatable salmon, like 30 feet long and 15 feet high, maintained inflated by one of those big fan contraptions. It was a story hour place for kids. The kids went in the tail. Somehow we got it wrong here and came out the mouth, but these are details. Next time, the other way. But they went in the tail, and then there was a story hour inside. On the other side of the Academy, there was two of our staffers and a snake in the corner of the main floor with a group of people around them talking about snakes. That's keeping the Academy new. There was a talk going on in one of the classrooms by a woman who is the illustrator for a new book on the alphabet called A is for Anaconda. And that room was full of people. You get the idea that the institution can be made new by big change, and it can also be made new by constant small change and interesting, almost ad hoc change. And we'd like that to be, I call it almost intellectual street theater, if you know what I mean. There's another area where we have an opportunity to change, and that is the digital dome, which used to be called a planetarium. Still is called a planetarium, but I think of it as the digital dome. Because the way we can use that dome to tell science stories is really powerful. And so our first show, which was Fragile Planet, was produced entirely at the Academy. Our next one coming will be a collaboration between the Academy and the American Museum on Journey to the Stars, I believe. And then we're working on what our third is going to be. And it may have nothing to do with stars at all. So we want the place to be always the same in a way. You'll be able to go to the alligator swamp, and there will be the alligator. And maybe Claude will even move. Claude is not known for moving. The fish will be there, but there'll always be something else going on, or a collection. Saturday, the place was magic. It also was magic on Sunday because of this interesting combination.
You know, I think it's really very interesting when we look at the combination of the new and the old. It's like everyone's still staring at the pendulum. You still have the crowds, you still have that. The planetarium, or now the digital dome, is really interesting. And I guess, has the technology for the digital dome changed?
No, well, the new dome is the largest totally digital planetarium in the world. Traditional planetariums had in the middle of them effectively a soup can with holes in it and a light bulb.
I was going to ask you about that.
That projected the stars. Now, it was a very expensive soup can and so forth
and
so on.
Yeah.
But it was limited to showing basically spots of light on the internal dome. The new planetarium has digital projectors which overlap and create a seamless image on the dome. And anything you can put in the digits, you can show a Brad Pitt movie in there, I presume, that you can put on the dome. And it greatly expands the kinds of stories you can tell. And the stories that are important to tell in science are much larger than the cosmos. You could do a wonderful production on DNA or on plate tectonics or on whatever. And so there's a lot of opportunity there for creativity. And we have a spectacular head of scientific visualization, Ryan Wyatt, who is a marvelously creative fellow and who headed with a team the group that created Fragile Planet, our first show, which fortunately was done in time. It was a bit of a nail-biter, but it was done in time.
Well, I hate to ask about the details, but the details is, what about the parking? Whoops.
It's not as plentiful as it might be. And what can you do? There seems to be a curious nature in San Francisco that if you make parking as difficult as possible, everyone will ride the bus. No, they just keep looking for a parking place. Now, I could pull out my Muni pass. I'm a faithful bus rider. But the garage could be double the size. Fortunately, it's there. When the de Young's Tut exhibit opens in a couple of weeks, so folks, people travel to us, and they travel by car. You can get there by public transportation. It's really easy. But if you're a visitor to town, getting to the park is not as easy as getting to Central Park West, unfortunately. And so we work with the city to create the culture bus. And I went to the mayor very early on after I got here and said, we need a culture bus. And it hasn't been a great success because people haven't ridden the culture bus. So we've got.
Where do you catch the culture bus?
This is the problem. Right outside the front door of this place.
Of this building. Okay. So where?
Well,
do we,
not quite, but Union Square.
We can get a map online.
Yes.
And what's the website name?
Of which?
Of the California Academy of Sciences.
www.calacademy.org.
Calacademy.org.
And if you're on an iPhone, we have a totally iPhone app, web presentation, and you can be someplace in Marin and press the button and say, take me to the Academy, and out will print MapQuest with directions. You've got no excuse not to come. But people will drive, and that's a peculiarity of San Francisco, and I can't do much about that. I find it frustrating, but we're working as much as we can on it. We're working to resurrect the intra-park shuttle so people can park at the beach, basically, and come to the Academy this summer. But there's a limit to what we actually can do.
Well, I think that we've all caught the science culture bus, and that's good enough. Thank you so much, Greg.
Okay.
We're actually not quite done. We have time for one more question, which I get to pick. And as Vice Chairman of the Business Leadership Forum, I would like to remind our radio audience listening at home that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our program this evening is with Dr. Greg Farrington, Executive Director of the California Academy of Sciences, speaking on the evolution of the new academy. Dr. Farrington is in conversation with Dr. Moira Gunn of NPR's Tech Nation. So, Greg, the final question for you has to do with religious differences. And I know you have some ideas about creationism. And here's the question. Given the message of modern science, which the Academy of Sciences represents so effectively, how can such a public institution deal with contrary religious views?
Well, we deal with science. And science is based upon the idea that what is real is what we can observe and reproduce. It doesn't matter how much we want to believe something. What matters is what we observe and what we can reproduce. And that's the essence of science. That was the great revolution that gave birth to scientific thinking. That's what makes science truly international and global. It's what you can observe and what you can reproduce. That doesn't mean that people at the same time don't have deep personal yearnings for meaning within the context of the world around us. Science is studying the world around us, trying to understand why are we here? Or how did we get here? What's the mechanism by which we're here? What's the universe anyway? But it doesn't really ask why we're here. It doesn't really answer why we're here. It comes upon a boundary which it has a hard time moving across. And so science limits itself to the issues of what we can observe, what we can model, what we can understand. Religion focuses on much sort of deeper yearnings that I would say almost all people have. There are many different religions, and they reflect that yearning. People sometimes think, you mentioned creationism, people sometimes say, well, you're teaching evolution, yes, because it's real. Why aren't you teaching the alternative, Genesis? Well, first of all, it's not the alternative. There are dozens of alternative creation stories. The issue of how we came here is so deep an issue for human beings, a yearning to understand. There are many different creation stories. There's a Christian one. There's a Hindu one. There's a Muslim one. There are dozens, simply dozens, if you go looking into the literature. Science simply says we posit as true what we can observe. and what we can reproduce. It doesn't matter what we want to believe. And to me, it doesn't take away at all from the magic of Genesis.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Greg Farrington, tonight. And I'd like to thank our interviewer, Dr. Moira Gunn. And I also want to thank our audience for attending. And now, with this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion, is adjourned.
Hey, that was great.
That was fun. Thanks.